Welcome to the 15th episode of the Divine Intervention Podcasts. My name is Divine. I'm a fourth year medical student. And in today's podcast, we're going to continue our story relating to metabolism. Okay, so let's jump right in. So the first slide talks about the central dogma of metabolism. Basically, this is not an actual central dogma, but it's just something you want to keep in mind to help you remember how insulin and glucagon affect metabolic pathways. So insulin, think of insulin as a dephosphorylator, and think of glucagon as a phosphorylator. If you can get this central principle into your head, it will make it very easy for you to remember many things. So insulin is a dephosphorylator, glucagon is a phosphorylator. So if insulin activates an enzyme, it activates it by dephosphorylation. If glucagon activates an enzyme, it activates it by phosphorylation. So next slide. So how is fructose absorbed in enterocytes? Well, that's with the GLUT5 transporter, okay? And how can glucose be converted to fructose? Well, the thing is, there is a pathway where glucose can be converted to something known as sorbitol, okay? With an enzyme known as aldose reductase. Aldose reductase reduces aldose sugars like glucose. And then there is another enzyme known as sorbitol dehydrogenase that converts sorbitol to fructose, okay? And the thing is, sorbitol dehydrogenase is highly expressed in certain tissues like seminal vesicles and stuff like that. But in other tissues, it's not necessarily expressed, or if it's expressed, it's expressed in very minute quantities. For example, like the lens of the eye, or Schwann cells and stuff like that, right? Or even the cells that line the nephron. So if you think about it, if you have limited expression of sorbitol dehydrogenase or no expression, you will basically stop at the conversion of glucose to sorbitol. And sorbitol is osmotically active. It can pull water into cells and it can cause osmotic damage. Okay, that's one potential mechanism behind the nephropathy and the neuropathy and the retinopathy that you get in diabetes. So what is the general pathophysiology behind lactase deficiency? In general, the older you get, at least in certain populations of individuals, especially Asians, it gets much harder to metabolize lactose, okay? So they have like reduced levels over time of lactase, okay? That's the general pathophysiology. There are very few people that have like absolutely no lactase from birth, okay? And remember, it's a brush border enzyme deficiency. That's another way they can test that concept on step one. Okay, next slide. So galactose metabolism, right? So you may see MET21. I'm just referring to some students at my med school. But basically, let's assume you're a milk lover, okay? You consume milk, and milk contains lactose, okay? And lactose is a disaccharide, right? So it's broken down by the brush border enzyme lactase to glucose and galactose, okay? And remember, glucose and galactose are both aldose sugars. As you'll see later, fructose is not an aldose sugar. It's a ketose sugar. Okay, so glucose and galactose, but in this case, we're dealing with galactose metabolism, so let's just keep going with the pathway. Galactose can be acted on by galactokinase to form galactose-1-phosphate, okay? And then galactose-1-phosphate uridyl transferase can help us go from galactose-1-phosphate to glucose-1-phosphate. You basically take the galactose and put it on UDP glucose. You take the glucose from UDP glucose and make glucose-1-phosphate. Okay, there's like some epimeries that exist that keeps that cycle going, but that's not relevant for board exams. Okay, so you form glucose-1-phosphate. That glucose-1-phosphate, by some magic, by some isomerase enzyme, you make glucose-6-phosphate, and then you can go into glycolysis. So there's a lot of pathology associated with this slide that I think is high yield to know for step one. Okay, the first thing is, as we've talked about on the preceding slide, if you have a lactase deficiency, that's a brush border enzyme deficiency, okay, pretty common in Asians, so that's the demographic you may see on exams. And if you have a lactase deficiency, lactose can build up in the lumen of your GI tract. That can osmotically draw water, okay, so you can get an osmotic diarrhea, okay, that's one pathology. Another pathology, we already talked about this with glucose being acted on by aldose reductase to form sorbitol, okay. Galactose can also be acted on by aldose reductase to form galactitol, okay? And these two things, again, are osmotically active. That's why if you see in galactose metabolism disorders, there's almost always cataracts, okay? Because the galactitol builds up in the lens, attracts water, that opacifies the lens, and you get cataracts, okay? But you don't get that in a fructose metabolism disorder, as you'll see on the next slide. Now, one high yield thing you want to know, if a person has classic galactosemia, I'm going to talk about that. I guess let me just talk about that next, and then I'll jump down to the green stuff at the bottom. Okay, so galactokinase deficiency, it's a deficiency of galactokinase, that's pretty obvious. And basically the thing that happens is if you have that deficiency, you have a lot of galactose in your blood, okay, but it's not very severe, okay. But the big thing you want to watch out for on that with that deficiency is that those people tend to have cataracts, again, for the galactitol reasons that I explained. That's one, because even if galactokinase cannot act on galactose, all those reductase can almost certainly act on galactose, okay? So you can get the cataracts with that. But the reason this is not very severe is that hexokinase can also actually act on galactose. So the phenotype is pretty mild. Other than the cataracts, you don't get very significant liver symptoms or anything of that sort. But if you have a second enzyme deficiency in galactose metabolism, that's a GALT deficiency or GAL1 phosphoradiotransferase, you have much more severe problems, right? Because the thing is, in galactokinase deficiency, you're not necessarily trapping galactose 1-phosphate in cells. In GALT deficiency, you are in fact trapping galactose 1-phosphate in cells. And GAL1 phos is very osmotically active, so that phosphate trapping can pull water, that like sugar, like phosphorylated sugar, it's trapped in the liver, for example, it can bring in water and it can destroy the hepatocytes. And you also get many other problems, right? So you get cataracts, like we said, for galactokinase deficiency, you get a lot of vomiting, okay, you get a lot of those kids classically have a mental retardation. It's actually a pretty nasty disease. So those people in general, they will want to avoid lactose or galactose containing items in the diet because they cannot metabolize galactose. Okay, now if you have a GALT deficiency, it's known as essential galactosemia. One high yield tidbit you certainly want to know for step one and even for step two and like shelf exams is that people that have a GALT deficiency, they have a very high risk of death from sepsis with E. coli. No one really knows why that's the case, but it's something you definitely want to know going forward. It's a very high yield concept. Not many people know that stuff, but it's something you definitely want to know for tests. So let's jump onto the next slide. Fructose metabolism, right? Fructose metabolism is a little simpler, okay? So you consume like fruits, right? Like oranges, right? That contains sucrose. Sucrose is also a disaccharide, okay? It's acted on by sucrase, okay, which is a brush powder enzyme. Remember, you can only reabsorb monosaccharides. You have no ability to reabsorb disaccharides. So that sucrase breaks up sucrose to glucose and fructose. We already talked about how fructose enters enterocytes with the GLUT5 transporter, okay? That transporter is also very heavily expressed in spermatocytes because sperm actually uses fructose as its source of energy. Okay, so fructose is then converted to fructose 1-phosphate by fructokinase. Okay, if you have a deficiency of fructokinase, that's something called essential fructosuria. You just have a ton of fructose in your blood, a ton of fructose in your urine. Not a big deal. Okay, it's a pretty benign. Again, because hexokinase also has the ability to act on fructose in a minor pathway. Now, fructose 1-phosphate is then cleaved by aldolase B, not aldolase A, aldolase B. Remember, aldolase B is in fructose metabolism, aldolase A is in glycolysis, okay? Aldolase B cleaves fructose 1-phosphate to DHAP, dihydroxyacetone phosphate, and glyceraldehyde, okay? If you have a deficiency of aldolase B, a second enzyme problem, okay, you have more severe issues, okay, again, because the fructose 1-phosphate is trapped in cells, because once the sugar is phosphorylated, it has a very hard time getting out of a cell. So that fructose 1-phosphate osmotically draws water into tissues, and you can get very, very serious problems with that. In fact, an aldolase B deficiency is known as fructose intolerance. So the principle I want you to establish here is that the first enzyme deficiency in galactose or fructose metabolism is bad but not very severe, but the second enzyme deficiency is almost always pretty devastating, okay? So that's one thing you certainly want to keep in mind, okay? And these kids tend to have like a lot of hypoglycemia, again, because the liver is not working right. Remember, the liver is the primary organ of gluconeogenesis. They have like increased levels of bilirubin because, again, remember that the liver takes takes care of like bilirubin metabolism. Sorry, the error with the urea cycle and all that stuff. But actually, these people actually tend to have a hyperammonemia because they go into liver failure relatively rapidly. Okay, and then the type 2 RTE business, I'll talk about it in a later podcast. I have to give like a big explanation to highlight that concept, but I'll talk about it later. But just remember that a type 2 RTE is associated with Aldolase B deficiency, which is a fructose intolerance. Just something to keep in mind. Now, fructose, like I said, is not an aldose sugar, it's a ketose sugar, okay? And as far as I know, there is no such thing as ketose reductase, okay? So you do not get the cataracts that you classically observe in galactose metabolic disorders, okay? So if you see cataracts on your exam, think of a problem with galactose metabolism. If you see no cataracts, think more about a problem with fructose metabolism. And if you go to the next slide, you also sort of want to like think of your temporal associations, right? Breast milk contains a lot of lactose, so galactose problems, galactose metabolism problems tend to show up like in the first few days of life versus fructose metabolism problems that tend to show up after like 6 months when fruits are slowly introduced into the diet, okay? And again, I already talked about how the second enzyme deficiency is more severe. Okay, so next slide. So discussion of microbe destruction in lysosomes of macrophages after phagocytosis by the respiratory burst, right? So basically, I'm referring to the respiratory burst pathway that operates in neutrophils, in macrophages, and in a lot of our white blood cells, right? So when you phagocytose something, you get it to the lysosome to destroy it, okay? And you use something known as the oxidative burst to make that happen. So the first step of the oxidative burst is an enzyme known as NADPH oxidase, okay? NADPH oxidase takes molecular oxygen and helps you convert it to superoxide radicals, okay? And then superoxide dismutase helps you convert those superoxide radicals to hydrogen peroxide, H2O2. And then myeloperoxidase converts the hydrogen peroxide to hypochlorous acid, which is basically bleach, okay? And if you have a deficiency of the first enzyme in that pathway, NADPH oxidase deficiency, you will have something known as chronic granulomatous disease, right? So in chronic granulomatous disease, those people have an NADPH oxidase deficiency. They basically cannot make hydrogen peroxide. So those people have to depend on the production of hydrogen peroxide from bacteria, okay? Those people, they co-opt the hydrogen peroxide from bacteria, act on it with myeloperoxidase, make bleach and kill that bacteria. But if that bacteria has an enzyme known as catalase, which has the ability to break up hydrogen peroxide to oxygen, I mean to basically metabolize it to water and oxygen, then those people would have an increased risk of infection with those kinds of organisms, right? So catalase positive organisms like Staph aureus, like E. coli, like Aspergillus, okay? So that's something you definitely want to keep in mind. Now, the ALS relationship is, I'm just trying to refer to the second enzyme in the pathway. I remember that a superoxide dismutase mutation is associated with familial amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. So that's just one factor you want to know. And the AML relationship is that, remember that myeloid cells have myeloperoxidase as a marker, okay? So remember, if you have a hematologic malignancy and it's myeloperoxidase positive, MPO positive, you know it's of myeloid origin, as against being of lymphoid origin. And another thing you can actually think of, those hour rods that you see in the M3 kind of AML, acute promyelocytic leukemia, those hour rods are actually made of myeloperoxidase. Remember that if those hour rods spill into circulation, they can cause a DIC and death. Now, glutathione is an agent that really helps us deal with oxidative stress, okay? And the thing is, it's actually a pretty essential pathway to providing reducing power for our cells, right? So if, for example, you're subjected to high stress with hydrogen peroxide, that hydrogen peroxide is converted to water and oxygen with an enzyme known as glutathione peroxidase. Glutathione peroxidase oxidizes glutathione, but remember, it's a redox reaction. So as something is being oxidized, the other thing is being reduced. As glutathione is oxidized from its reduced form to its oxidized form, Hydrogen peroxide is converted from its oxidized form to its reduced form, which is water and oxygen, which is much safer. But if you want to keep that cycle going, you need to reconvert the oxidized glutathione back to reduced glutathione. You do that with an enzyme known as glutathione reductase, okay? And that enzyme depends on NADPH as a cofactor. That's why you can see that if you have a G6PD deficiency where you're not making NADPH, okay? Because remember, the pentose phosphate pathway, one of its byproducts is NADPH. If you have a G6PD deficiency, you're not making NADPH. You're not making a cofactor for the regeneration of reduced glutathione to keep that glutathione cycle going. And one thing I will bring into play here is that there is a drug that actually works like, it's basically a glutathione analog because it has a lot of sulfhydryl groups. The drug I'm referring to is N-acetylcysteine, okay? N-acetylcysteine is a pretty ubiquitous drug. It you can use it to treat acetaminophen toxicity because remember, acetaminophen can be metabolized to an agent known as NAPQI, okay? And that NAPQI is a very powerful oxidizing agent. So if you give reducing power in the form of N-acetylcysteine, okay, you could dumb down the oxidative damage that you get with acetaminophen toxicity, and you could potentially stave off liver damage. Okay, so that's one thing N-acetylcysteine can do for you. Okay, N-acetylcysteine can do many other things, right? So it can cleave disulfide bonds, okay, in mucus plugs. So you can use that to treat the cystic fibrosis to sort of break up the nasty goopy stuff that clogs up their airways. You can actually use N-acetylcysteine as well to prevent contrast-induced nephropathy, okay? Because one of the thoughts is that contrast creates a lot of free radicals that damage the kidney and cause a kind of intrarenal, acute renal failure, okay? So you can give N-acetylcysteine prophylactically to sort of prevent that. Another thing you can use N-acetylcysteine for is you can actually use it to prophylax against the bladder toxicity, right? The hemorrhagic cystitis that you get with cyclophosphamide. Remember, cyclophosphamide makes a metabolite known as acroline, and that acroline is toxic to the bladder. You're classically thought that you could use Mesna for that, and Mesna does in fact work better, but you could get an unusual step one question where N-acetylcysteine is actually the right answer, okay? You can actually use N-acetylcysteine to prophylax against the hemorrhagic cystitis that goes with cyclophosphamide. Now, CGD, I already talked about how CGD is treated in the previous podcast. I said because it's a macrophage problem, you can try to give something that spruces up macrophage function like interferon gamma. Okay, next slide. So how does isoniazid cause seizures? How does isoniazid cause seizures? The mechanism behind isoniazid causing seizures is that isoniazid depletes your vitamin B6, and it so happens that vitamin B6 is the cofactor for an enzyme known as glutamate decarboxylase. Glutamate decarboxylase helps you go from glutamate to GABA, okay, and glutamate is sort of an excitatory neurotransmitter. GABA is an inhibitory neurotransmitter, okay? So if you deplete your B6, you have no cofactor for glutamate decarboxylase, your glutamate levels build up, okay, and you can get seizures with that, okay? So that's one potential mechanism behind INH causing seizures. And I want to draw your attention to the fact that autoantibodies against glutamate decarboxylase are associated with type 1 diabetes. Okay, and this is another like off-putting question. How does the urea cycle relate to nitric oxide synthesis? Remember that one of the byproducts of the urea cycle is arginine, okay? And arginine can be acted on by nitric oxide synthase to make nitric oxide. Remember, nitric oxide is a powerful vasodilator, so it decreases afterload. Now, next question says, patient with recurrent episodes of bronchospasm, flushing and diarrhea, okay, presents with new onset memory loss and a diffuse body rash. A holosystolic murmur is heard at the left lower sternal border, okay? So if you see a person having bronchospasm, they have flushing, they have diarrhea, okay? I really hope you're thinking about carcinoid syndrome, okay? There's a very nice mnemonic for carcinoid syndrome. It's called BFDR, okay? The B stands for bronchospasm, the F stands for flushing, the D stands for diarrhea, and the R stands for right-sided heart lesions. The reason you get right-sided heart lesions is that the serotonin that's secreted by the carcinoid tumor can be metabolized by the lungs, okay? So the serotonin will basically like screw up the right side of your heart, but the lung endothelium has the ability to metabolize that serotonin, okay? So it doesn't make its way to the left side of your heart, so you do not get left-sided heart problems. Okay, and in general, you get symptoms with carcinoid syndrome when you have mets to the liver. The most common location of carcinoid tumor is in the appendix. Okay, so the liver has the ability, just like the lungs, to metabolize the serotonin. But once you have mets from the appendix to the liver, then the serotonin can then move all over the body and begin to cause these systemic symptoms. Okay, so why does this person have this new, and hopefully remember, holosystolic murmur, left lower sternal border? I really hope you're thinking about a tricuspid regurg. Okay, in general, in carcinoid syndrome, you either get tricuspid regurg or pulmonic stenosis. Tricuspid regurg or pulmonic stenosis. Okay, there's a nice mnemonic for that. It's called TIPS. Okay, tricuspid insufficiency, pulmonic stenosis. Those are the lesions you tend to get with carcinoid syndrome. Now, why does this person have new onset memory loss and a diffuse body rash? Well, carcinoid is a tumor that over-secretes serotonin. Where does serotonin come from? I mean, if I'll give you a clue. Serotonin is also known as 5-HT or 5-hydroxytryptophan. Okay, so that should tell you that it comes from tryptophan. Okay, it so happens that tryptophan is also a precursor to the formation of niacin, vitamin B3. Okay, so if you're diverting all the tryptophan that you have in your body towards the synthesis of serotonin, because a person has carcinoid syndrome, they don't make as much niacin as they could make, okay, and they can get pellagra from that. Okay, remember the 4 D's of pellagra. Okay, diarrhea, okay, dermatitis, right, so that's the skin rash, dementia, right, so that's the memory loss, and death, which is not ideal. So that's something you want to keep in mind, okay? And I've talked about the valvular lesions. And the real quick thing I will just say about hydroxylation reactions, it's not always true, but I will see that tetrahydrobiopterin, BH4, appears to be a pretty common cofactor for many hydroxylation reactions in the body. Take, for example, the conversion of phenylalanine to tyrosine with phenylalanine hydroxylase. Remember, that's the enzyme that's deficient in a PKU, okay? But basically, that's a hydroxylation reaction. It depends on BH4, okay? There's at least like 4 or 5 biochem reactions that are tested on step one that also have BH4 as a cofactor. So just take that concept away. Tetrahydrobiopterin, BH4 cofactor for hydroxylation reactions in the body, especially with amino acids. Okay, so next slide. Location of fatty acid synthesis, right? So where does fatty acid synthesis happen? Fatty acid synthesis happens in the cytosol. Okay, that's an easy question. The feedstock for fatty acid synthesis is acetyl-CoA. Okay, you basically join up a bunch of acetyl-CoA monomers to make a fatty acid. Okay, and how does this feedstock leave the mitochondria? Well, the thing is, acetyl-CoA cannot leave the mitochondria on its own, okay? The way acetyl-CoA leaves the mitochondria is that it's converted to citrate, okay? So acetyl-CoA is 2 carbons. It pairs up with oxaloacetate, 4 carbons, to make citrate, okay? There's a citrate transporter in the mitochondrial membrane, so that citrate goes out the mitochondria, okay? And then that citrate, it's split right back into oxaloacetate. So this is now in the cytosol. It split right back into oxaloacetate and acetyl-CoA. That acetyl-CoA continues its destiny for fatty acid synthesis. The oxaloacetate continues its destiny for a pathway I'm going to talk about in a few minutes, okay? So that's how the acetyl-CoA gets out of the mitochondria. And you may ask yourself, come on, Divine, can't the acetyl-CoA just do the TCA cycle in the mitochondria and be done for the day? Well, the thing is, if the TCA cycle keeps running, you'll make a ton of ATP, you'll make a ton of NADH. That ATP and NADH are very powerful inhibitors of the rate-limiting enzyme of the TCA cycle, isocitrate dehydrogenase, okay? So when they inhibit that enzyme, everything proximal to that enzyme begins to build up, like acetyl-CoA, okay? That's the inducement for fatty acid synthesis to begin. Now, the rate-limiting enzyme of fatty acid synthesis is acetyl-CoA carboxylase, okay? Basically helps you convert acetyl-CoA to malonyl-CoA, and then you do some magic, and you ultimately make a fatty acid, okay? Now, acetyl-CoA carboxylase has carboxylase in the name. Any enzyme that is a carboxylase enzyme always uses 3 things, okay? It uses ATP in that reaction, that's an A. It uses biotin in that reaction, that's a B, that's vitamin B7, okay? And then it uses CO2 in that reaction as well, because it's a carboxylase enzyme, right? So it should make sense that it uses carbon dioxide, okay? So all carboxylase enzymes are ABC enzymes. They use ATP, biotin or vitamin B7 and CO2. And remember that you can get a biotin deficiency if you consume a ton of egg whites, okay? All right, because egg whites contain avidin, and avidin is a very powerful vitamin B7 binder. Okay, now, how is fatty acid synthesis regulated? Well, fatty acid synthesis is regulated by three primary mechanisms you want to know, primarily in the context of acetyl-CoA carboxylase, okay? So, think about it. Will insulin or glucagon promote the storage of fat? Well, I hope you're thinking insulin. And how does insulin work? Is insulin a phosphorylator or a dephosphorylator? I said this in the beginning, it's a dephosphorylator, okay? So that means the dephosphorylated form of acetyl-CoA carboxylase is the active form, okay? While the phosphorylated form of acetyl-CoA carboxylase is the inactive form, okay? So when acetyl-CoA carboxylase is not phosphorylated, it's active. That's what insulin wants. When acetyl-CoA carboxylase is phosphorylated, it is not active. That is what glucagon wants, okay? Remember, glucagon works through a G-protein coupled receptor, okay? Now, in terms of feedforward activation, citrate is a powerful feedforward activator of acetyl-CoA carboxylase, okay? But the product of fatty acid synthesis, palmitoyl-CoA, it's like a 16-carbon fatty acid, is a very powerful feedback inhibitor of acetyl-CoA carboxylase. So that's the way acetyl-CoA carboxylase is mentioned in general. And citrate feedforward activating acetyl-CoA carboxylase just reminds me to tell you that if you go back to glycolysis, right, the last enzyme of glycolysis, pyruvate kinase, okay, it's actually regulated by feedforward activation, okay, with a substrate known as fructose-1,6-bisphosphate. Fructose-1,6-bisphosphate is actually a feedforward activator of pyruvate kinase, okay? Feedforward activation is not very common in metabolism, so whenever it pops up, it's usually high yield for exams. The two high-yield essential fatty acids, there's alpha-linolenic acid and linoleic acid. That's just something you want to memorize. It's commonly tested on exams. And then the two sources of NADPH for fatty acid synthesis. I'll say the big thing you want to remember here is that G6PD, glucose-6-phosphodehydrogenase, from the oxidative phase of the pentose phosphate pathway, makes NADPH as a byproduct. So that's one source of NADPH. But there is another high yield source of NADPH that I'm going to talk about now. So this is where I'm going back to that citrate story that I sort of dropped for a bit, right? So we said that in the mitochondria, acetyl-CoA cannot make its way out. So it combines with oxaloacetate, you form citrate. That citrate goes through a citrate transporter, okay? And then that citrate is cleaved by an enzyme known as ATP citrate lyase into acetyl-CoA that continues its destiny as a part of the fatty acid synthesis. And then that oxaloacetate is actually reconverted back to malate, okay, in the cytosol, by an enzyme known as malate dehydrogenase, okay? Malate dehydrogenase does, in fact, also exist in the mitochondria, but there is another isoform that also exists in the cytosol, okay? So malate dehydrogenase converts oxaloacetate to malate, and then that malate can be converted back to pyruvate by an enzyme known as NADP-dependent malic enzyme, okay? Malic enzyme converts malate to pyruvate, but it actually forms NADPH as a byproduct. And then that pyruvate can be recycled back into the mitochondria to go back to the TCA cycle or to keep the cycle of fatty acid synthesis going, okay? Because it can undergo the pyruvate dehydrogenase complex, make acetyl-CoA, that acetyl-CoA can pair up with oxaloacetate again, form citrate, get out of the cell, and then do what I just described, okay? So those are the two high-yield sources of NADPH, malic enzyme and glucose-6-phosphodehydrogenase. So next slide. Now, we're jumping into glycolysis, okay? Glycolysis, you don't need to know the enzymes in the pathway, but I'll say there are certain high-yield enzymes you generally want to know, and I'm going to emphasize them. And while I'm concurrently discussing the pathway, I'll also discuss the regulation, okay? So the first step of glycolysis is that you want to trap glucose in a cell. You trap glucose in cells by phosphorylating glucose, okay? So how do you phosphorylate glucose? You use a kinase. Kinases are enzymes that phosphorylate things. So hexokinase, right? Hexo, six carbons. Glucose is a six-carbon sugar. It's a six-carbon aldose sugar. So hexokinase converts glucose to glucose-6-phosphate, okay? Remember that in general, you find hexokinase everywhere in the body, okay? But the enzyme that does that same reaction in the liver, in the beta cells of the pancreas, in the kidneys, for example, is glucokinase, okay? Glucokinase helps us convert glucose to glucose-6-phosphate, Okay, and remember that if you wanted to reverse that reaction in gluconeogenesis, for example, that will be with the use of glucose-6-phosphatase. Okay, remember that enzyme is highly expressed in the endoplasmic reticulum. Okay, and if you have a deficiency of glucose-6-phosphatase, you have a glycogen storage disease type 1. Okay, that's von Gehrig's disease. Now, there are certain different high yield differences between hexokinase and glucokinase. Okay, hexokinase is feedback inhibited by glucose-6-phosphate, which is its product. Okay, but glucokinase is not. Okay, glucokinase, like I said, it's more liver specific. It's not feedback inhibited by glucose-6-phosphate. It's actually feedback inhibited by fructose-6-phosphate, and I'll talk about the mechanism behind that in an upcoming slide. Okay, and unlike hexokinase, where insulin does not necessarily increase its genetic expression, insulin does increase the genetic expression of glucokinase. So that's another high yield thing you want to keep in mind. Okay, and again, this first step is to phosphorylate the glucose so you can trap the glucose in the cell. Now, next slide. Okay, so key differences between hexo and glucokinase. Hexokinase has a low Km, so it has a very high affinity for glucose. Okay, and it has a very low Vmax. Okay, so it has a it gets to its maximum rate of reaction very quickly. And why does this make any sense? It should make sense because hexokinase is expressed in many tissues of the body, like the brain, for example. You want your brain always depends on glucose. So even if your blood glucose levels are low, okay, hexokinase will be working at max capacity, which is a good thing, okay, because you want to supply glucose to your organs. But glucokinase is different. Glucokinase, think of it as a glucose sensing enzyme, okay? It has a high Km and it has a high Vmax. Because the thing is, by having a high Km and a high Vmax, that means there is a very wide range over blood glucose concentrations over which glucokinase can work. That's why it works as a very good sensor. Okay, and the thing is, when you hit blood glucose levels of like 15 millimolar, for example, right, hexokinase is already operating at like max speed, okay, but glucokinase is beginning to get going, and that helps you again bring more glucose into the liver so that you can store it as glycogen, for example. Okay, so glucokinase has a high Km, so it has a lower affinity for glucose, and it has a high Vmax. And because it has a high Km and it has low affinity, if you have a mutation in glucokinase, okay, you won't be able to sense blood glucose levels very well. Okay, so you'll be hyperglycemic for longer periods of time, and that can create a kind of diabetes. That's known as MODY, maturity onset of diabetes of the young. Okay, it's classically like the fit diabetic. Like you see these people, they're diabetic, but they're super fit. They're like, I'm not saying they're ripped or anything, but they're not obese like you observe in many diabetics. Okay. So let's jump to the next slide and talk about how glucokinase is regulated. So glucokinase is regulated by a protein known as glucokinase regulatory protein. Okay, the way this protein works is that it binds to glucokinase and sends it to the nucleus. Glucokinase is useless in the nucleus. Okay, but the thing is, glucokinase regulatory protein has the ability to bind fructose-6-phosphate or glucose. Okay, when it's bound by glucose, it has a lower affinity for glucokinase, so glucokinase can then come out of the nucleus, come to the cytosol and do its job. But if glucokinase regulatory protein is bound by fructose-6-phosphate, it actually makes it have a higher affinity for glucokinase. When it has a higher affinity for glucokinase, it takes it to the nucleus and glucokinase cannot do its job. Okay, so this is how fructose-6-phosphate negatively regulates the activity of glucokinase. So next slide. So next step of glycolysis, right? So it's where you go from fructose-6-phosphate to fructose-1,6-bisphosphate. The enzyme that helps you go from glucose-6-phosphate to fructose-6-phosphate is not relevant for exams. But fructose-6-phosphate is converted to fructose-1,6-bisphosphate by the rate-limiting enzyme of glycolysis known as PFK1, phosphofructokinase 1. Okay, and phosphofructokinase 1, right, because it's the rate-limiting enzyme of glycolysis, it has a lot of regulation. Okay, it has a lot of regulation. And if you think about it, if glycolysis helps you make energetic intermediates, it should thus make sense that anything that speaks high energy should inhibit PFK1. Anything that screams low energy should activate PFK1. Because if you have low energy, you want glycolysis to happen so you can make ATP to power the cell. So a low energy substrate like AMP, adenosine monophosphate, actually activates PFK1, but high energy indicators like ATP and citrate actually inhibit PFK1. Okay, But there is something else that also activates PFK1, and this is fructose 2,6 bisphosphate. Think of fructose 2,6 bisphosphate as the conduit that enables humans to hormonally regulate the activity of PFK1. Okay, so just like fructose 1,6 bisphosphate is made by PFK1, fructose 2,6 bisphosphate is made by PFK2. Okay, that's not where the story ends. It so happens that PFK2 is part of a bifunctional enzyme complex. Okay, the bifunctional enzyme complex includes PFK2, which converts fructose 6-phosphate to fructose 2,6 bisphosphate, and fructose 2,6 bisphosphatase, which reverses that reaction, converts fructose 2,6 bisphosphate to fructose 6-phosphate. Okay, so the thing is, I just told you that fructose 2,6 bisphosphate is an activator of PFK1. Okay, and we know that insulin is proglycolysis, so it should make sense that the formation of fructose 2,6 bisphosphate is encouraged by insulin. And if we know that PFK2 helps us make fructose 2,6 bisphosphate, and you know that insulin is proglycolysis and fructose 2,6 bisphosphate is an activator of PFK1, that should help you remember that the dephosphorylated form of PFK2 is its active form. Okay, so when you dephosphorylate PFK2, right, you activate PFK2, you make more fructose 2,6 bisphosphate, okay, and then that fructose 2,6 bisphosphate can then go and activate PFK1. Okay, I'm not going to talk about the reverse reaction because it's just something you have to take the opposite off, okay, and you will get that regulation down. Okay, this is not something you really need to memorize. If you just remember the central dogma of metabolism I talked about earlier, and you talk about how insulin is a dephosphorylator and how it's a proglycolysis, you can basically recreate all this from memory. So next slide. So fructose 2,6 bisphosphate broken down by aldolase A, not aldolase B. Remember, aldolase B is the enzyme that's deficient in hereditary fructose intolerance. Okay, but aldolase A converts fructose 1,6 bisphosphate to DHAP, dihydroxyacetone phosphate, and glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate. Okay, and that glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate, okay, can be converted by glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate dehydrogenase to 1,3-bisphosphoglycerate. Okay, because this enzyme, glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate dehydrogenase, has dehydrogenase in the name, you should know that you're either using up or making NADH, FADH2, or NADPH in this reaction. In this reaction, we're actually making NADH. Okay. This NADH can actually have multiple fates, okay? It can actually go to the electron transport chain to complex 1, okay? To supply power for the synthesis of ATP. Another thing that the red cells actually use this NADH for is that they use it to convert methemoglobin, which is hemoglobin that has iron in the 3+ state, the ferric form, to regular hemoglobin, which has iron in the 2+ state. Okay, remember, 2+ iron is the iron that can carry oxygen. 3+ iron actually cannot carry oxygen. Okay, so methemoglobin reductase uses NADH as a cofactor to convert methemoglobin to hemoglobin in a red cell, because a red cell's job is to carry oxygen. Okay, but another thing you want to keep in mind is that methemoglobin actually has a very good ability to bind cyanide. Okay, so if a person actually is poisoned with cyanide, one treatment is to actually induce a methemoglobinemia with a drug known as ammonitrate. It's a powerful oxidizing agent. Remember, oxidation is an increase in oxidation number. If your oxidation number is becoming more positive, you're oxidizing a substance. Okay, so you go from Fe2+ to Fe3+. Fe3+ has a very high affinity for cyanide. You bind up that cyanide, and then you give thiosulfate to help you form thiocyanate, and then you poop or pee out the cyanide safely. Okay, so that's one application of this pathway. Okay, and off to the side, you'll see glycerol 3-phosphate listed as coming from dihydroxyacetone phosphate under the action of the enzyme glycerol 3-phosphate dehydrogenase. Please don't confuse glycerol 3-phosphate dehydrogenase with glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate dehydrogenase. Okay, glycerol 3-phosphate dehydrogenase helps you make glycerol 3-phosphate. Okay, glycerol 3-phosphate is used for triglyceride synthesis. I'll talk about that in a later podcast. Next slide. So 1,3-bisphosphoglycerate can be converted to 3-phosphoglycerate. Okay, so this is the first step where you make ATP in glycolysis. Okay, this is substrate level phosphorylation. So you're converting ADP directly to ATP. Okay, and then by some magic, you go from 3-phosphoglyceride to phosphoenolpyruvate, and then you have the last step of glycolysis. Okay, the last step here is that phosphoenolpyruvate is converted to pyruvate by an enzyme known as pyruvate kinase. I already talked about how pyruvate kinase is feed-forward activated by fructose 1,6-bisphosphate. Okay, what's the other enzyme I mentioned that is also feed-forward activated? Acetyl-CoA carboxylase. Okay, remember, that's feed-forward activated by citrate. So, pyruvate kinase converts phosphoenolpyruvate to pyruvate. Okay, in addition to being activated by fructose 1,6-bisphosphate, anything, again, that screams high energy inhibits pyruvate kinase. Okay, so ATP is an inhibitor of pyruvate kinase. Alanine is also an inhibitor of pyruvate kinase, and that should sort of make sense. If you have high levels of alanine, it's kind of indicative potentially of a high energy state, because pyruvate can be converted by ALT to alanine. Okay, pyruvate is like the alpha keto acid of alanine. Okay, so it should sort of make sense that alanine is an inhibitor of pyruvate kinase. And remember that a pyruvate kinase deficiency is actually one of the most common causes, one of the most common glycolytic enzyme deficiencies that perpetuates a hemolytic anemia. I'll talk about the mechanism behind that in a different podcast. So this pyruvate kinase step also makes ATP. Okay, and again, this is another example of substrate level phosphorylation. Now, on the left of this slide, you see 1,3-BPG being converted to 2,3-BPG. Okay, there's an enzyme known as BPG mutase that does that. It's actually a pretty heavily expressed enzyme in red cells. And you may ask yourself, why does this make any sense? Well, remember that 2,3-BPG, okay, binds to the beta subunit of hemoglobin. Remember, hemoglobin has two alphas and two betas, okay, at least hemoglobin A. So that beta subunit can be bound by 2,3-BPG, and that shifts the oxyhemoglobin dissociation curve to the right, okay, so that it can enable red cells to release more oxygen, okay? But contrast that with fetal hemoglobin, that is 2-alpha, 2-gamma, has no beta subunits, okay? You need those beta subunits to bind 2,3-BPG, okay? So because fetal hemoglobin does not have that beta subunit, it cannot bind 2,3-BPG. That's why hemoglobin F is left-shifted, and that makes sense because it creates a gradient of oxygen flow from maternal hemoglobin, which should be hemoglobin A, to the fetal hemoglobin, which is hemoglobin F, because hemoglobin F has a higher affinity for oxygen compared to hemoglobin A. Okay, so next slide. Some other important stuff. Pyruvate kinase, you can almost predict what I'm going to say here, right? It's regulated by phosphorylation and dephosphorylation, right? And we already established that insulin is pro-glycolysis, okay? So that means that the dephosphorylated form of pyruvate kinase is the active form, okay? So hopefully with this, you're seeing that regulation in metabolism is actually very easy to remember, okay? You just need to put certain principles together, and you don't need to memorize much, okay? And in glycolysis, you make two ATPs, okay? Two net ATPs, you make two net NADHs and two pyruvates, okay? Remember, you're getting two pyruvates because glucose 6-carbon is split into two pyruvates, okay? And pyruvate has many fates, okay? It can form lactate under the action of lactate dehydrogenase. Basically, the point of this step is it helps to regenerate NAD so that the glycerol, the high 3-phosphate dehydrogenase step can keep working, okay? Alternatively, pyruvate can go into the mitochondria and be acted on by the pyruvate dehydrogenase complex. I'll talk about that in a different podcast, to make acetyl-CoA, okay? Another thing that could happen is that pyruvate can be acted on by pyruvate carboxylase, okay, which uses acetyl-CoA as a cofactor, okay? Acetyl-CoA is a very powerful allosteric, in fact, I'll say it's an obligate activator of pyruvate carboxylase, okay? You can form OAA from that. And again, because it's a carboxylase enzyme, it's adding an extra CO2, okay? That's why you're going from 3-carbon pyruvate to 4-carbon oxaloacetate. And that oxaloacetate can make its way up the glycolysis chain, because remember, many of those reactions are reversible to ultimately form glucose in gluconeogenesis. Okay, and remember that because pyruvate carboxylase, again, is a carboxylase enzyme, it's ABC, so it uses ATP, uses biotin, and uses carbon dioxide. Okay, so next slide. GLUT transporters, so this is what I'm going to end with today. GLUT transporters, basically, you just want to know that They're heavily expressed in specific organs of the body, and you want to know which organ expresses what. Okay, so like GLUT1. GLUT1 is found in the brain and red cells. It has a low KM again, because your brain and your red cells, they depend very heavily on glycolysis. Okay, so because it has a low KM, it has a very high affinity for glucose, so that even if your blood glucose levels are super low, those transporters are still working super well, okay, to maintain your blood glucose levels. Now, GLUT2 is found in the pancreas, okay, the beta cells of the pancreas and in the liver, okay. And the GLUT2 transporter is bidirectional, and it should make sense because remember, the liver participates in glycolysis, but it also participates in gluconeogenesis. So the liver, even if it brings glucose in through the GLUT2 transporter, it can also export that glucose through the GLUT2 transporter as well, okay? Because remember that the liver expresses glucose 6-phosphate, so it can convert glucose 6-phosphate to glucose, okay? So if you're an organ that supplies glucose to other organs, you should have a bidirectional transporter. That should kind of make sense, okay? Because that glucose actually has to leave the liver, for example, in some way, shape, or form. Now, GLUT3 is expressed in many tissues, is also expressed in the brain. GLUT4 is expressed in adipocytes and in muscle. Okay, I remember that with 4AM. Okay, so GLUT4, adipocytes, and muscle. And one special thing to know about GLUT4 is it's actually induced by insulin. Okay, you don't necessarily make more GLUT4 with insulin. But insulin, one of the things it does is it causes you to place more GLUT4 transporters on the cell membrane of an adipocyte or skeletal muscle, okay? And then GLUT5, I already talked about how that transports fructose, okay? And then glucose, remember when you consume glucose and it's broken down by those brush border disaccharidases, of which lactase is an example, okay? You form those monosaccharides. Those monosaccharides, they go in through secondary active transport into the enterocyte by using the SGLT transporters, the sodium glucose linked transporters. Remember that sodium is primarily an extracellular ion, okay? So as it goes down its gradient into the cell, it carries glucose alongside, okay? SGLT1. Don't forget SGLT2 transporters that you find in the proximal convoluted tubule that are inhibited by drugs like canagliflozin. Okay, that's an anti-diabetes medication. I'll talk about that drug in a different podcast. Okay, so the last slide, GLUT1 transporters, again, they have a low KM. Okay, so they basically bring in a constant amount of glucose per unit of time. Okay, contrast that with the GLUT2 transporters that have a much higher KM, lower affinity. So they bring in a more constant fraction of glucose per unit of time. And the thing is, again, think of your liver, your beta cells of the pancreas, let's say more beta cells of the pancreas, as having a glucose sensing mechanism. Okay, this is actually kind of coupled to the GLUT2 transporter. Okay, and I've talked about why the GLUT2 transporters are bidirectional, and I've talked about how GLUT4 transporters are insulin dependent. Although when you begin to work out, your muscle needs glucose like crazy. Okay, so there is actually an insulin independent mechanism where you can put more GLUT4 transporters on the surface of skeletal muscle in the setting of exercise. Okay, that's why exercise is good for diabetes, because you don't necessarily need insulin, but you're just putting GLUT4 on the surface of skeletal muscle and skeletal muscle cells. So you're basically clearing the blood of glucose. Okay, so that's where we're going to stop today. I'm going to pick up with another podcast. I hope you have a wonderful day. God bless you, and I'll see you next time. Thank you.